So when you're in a judo competition and you start to feel yourself become nervous, you become aware of that. You need a little bit of nerves, that adrenaline, that helps keep you sharp. But there's obviously a sweet spot.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to a new episode of the Judo Edit podcast. I'm your host, Melissa Budiato, and today we are chatting with David Groom, former Great Britain athlete, former British champion at 90 kilograms. David represented Great Britain for 11 years at competitions and training camps in over 40 different countries. He's built a strong judo resume full of hard work and experience, and is the founder of Emotionally Intelligent Way of Life, a business set up to mentor and guide others. Great to have you on the show, David. How are you going today?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you, Melissa. How are you?
I'm really good. I'm super excited to talk to you because you sound like you've got a lot of knowledge there. So tell us, we're sitting here in Sydney, Australia, and that's a long way from where your story started. So can you share with us where you grew up and how you started judo?
Yeah, of course. So I started judo at the age of 9 in a small town in the north of England called Bacup. So it's about 20 miles away from Manchester. Now, just so happened that the town had one of the best judo clubs in the country at that particular time. The coach there was coach of the Great Britain cadet squad. And there was a large number of national representatives, international competitors, Olympians, all training out of this small club. So very, very fortunate. It was just complete chance. So obviously that was, it was a bit of a rocky start.
Yeah, what do you mean by a rocky start?
When I first started judo, I didn't particularly like it. I was a bit of a soft kid.
Okay.
And obviously getting thrown just did not find it enjoyable. So after a couple of weeks of doing judo, decided to stop. And then a year or two later, my little brother, he showed an interest in wanting to go. So my parents took him along, and obviously the sibling rivalry was strong, and my little brother was going to do it, and I also was going to do it.
Of course.
During them few years, I toughened up a little bit, and the second time around, say when I was about 9, that's when I showed a lot more interest in the sport, found it a lot more enjoyable. And it slowly sort of developed from going once a week to going several times a week, and then competitions, and then sort of snowballed from there, really.
Yeah, great. And so when did you realise that, you know, you were hooked and you wanted to be a competitor in this sport?
Around the age of 13. So up until that point, I'd just started representing the Northwest area. I'd done my first competition abroad, a competition in Sweden. I'd done my first national championships and hadn't gone too well. The competition in Sweden, I was completely out of my depth. I mean, there was like maybe 600-700 kids there competing.
Wow.
It was my first trip, let's say, away. There's a group of lads that were like one. I was one of the younger ones. For the Northwest team, who sort of up until maybe 16, 17 year olds, and as a big group, maybe about 30 of us went over. And as I say, there's just a massive crowd. There's so many people there. There's training camp, you know, kids from all over Europe, and got battered pretty much every session. It was a bit of a sort of like shock to the system. And then, you know, fast forward, I did the nationals that year and I won one or two fights, but pretty much got beaten up again. Then fast forward to 13, things started to fit in a little bit better. Fought in Sweden again, and I medaled this time, and just found the camp a little bit easier, and just starting to have a few more results. And just started to think, you know, actually, okay, it's like obviously a year, a little bit older now, like a teenager. I mean, it's a long time, a year at that age in terms of the development, and it just started to feel a little bit more fun.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So once you started getting those results, you could really see like your improvement, and that's sort of what, I guess, solidified your decision to keep committing to training?
Yeah.
And so how would you describe your style of judo?
It's an interesting question.
Do you fight left-handed, right-handed?
I'm a left-handed fighter. I wouldn't necessarily describe my judo as traditional.
Okay.
I mean, my coach used to describe it as a bit of a mess. I'm pretty much well known for throwing my left arm over the top, sticking my left leg across for Osoto or Haragoshi and sort of hoping for the best.
Yeah, yeah. But it works.
And it works, yeah.
There you go.
So I've always found anything that I usually do, I try to be precise, never seems to go, doesn't suit my style.
Okay.
So as a kid, I never coloured between the lines in a colouring book.
Yeah, yeah.
But when I try and obviously for judo, you know, you've got to obviously have the technical abilities and you've got to be precise to a certain point. And obviously, yeah, like doing the kata and having to do gradings, there's got to be that element.
Yeah.
But that's the element that I always struggled with the most.
Yeah, yeah. No, I see. And but do you think that almost gave you a little bit of an advantage because it made your throws a little bit different to what people had trained against, or like it was a bit more unpredictable?
Yeah. Sometimes I come off a fight and I'm never sure who's more surprised. Me that I threw them or they're not got beam thrown.
Yeah.
There's always definitely a bit of a sort of a look of like, what was that?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, win's a win.
Yeah, did you ever model your style off anybody, or was it sort of organic that you developed this style?
Sort of organic, really.
Yeah, yeah. So
there were definitely people that I you know, as a judo young judo player. As I was growing up, obviously in the UK, I mean, like Neil Adams was one of the idols that I had, you know, and he used to do seminars, still does as far as I'm aware. And, you know, when I was a kid, I went to a couple of his seminars and I was like never going to be able to do Taitoshi or Uchimatsu as well as he could.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he was someone that,
yeah,
I admired in terms of technical yeah, abilities, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So he had like Taitoshis and, well, did he do drop Taitoshis as well?
Just, yeah, like, yeah.
So he, many variations.
Uchimata was another one of his big throws. And then obviously he was just an incredible Niwaza player, and his Juju Katam was just phenomenal.
Yeah, for sure.
So,
well, Neil, we've given him a shout out, so hopefully he decides that he'd like to come on this show. I've reached out to him before, but I think he's a very busy person. Who are the judo sort of role models, I guess, apart from Neil Adams, that you had growing up?
Probably my biggest role model through judo, and even now, was my coach, Brian Moore.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, at the time when I first started doing judo, he was the cadet squad manager for Great, yeah, Britain.
Yeah.
And so the club where I trained at, that would host my Great Britain squad trainings every now and again and camps. So from a young age, I was able to take advantage of training with these players. And as I say, when I was younger, I'd just get beaten up. And but it's sort of that rite of passage, you know. And then obviously you get to a point where you're one of the better ones and older ones. It's sort of like a trial by fire.
Yeah.
So Brian obviously encouraged me and pushed me and to sort of train above my abilities. Which again, when I was younger, so I was a bit of a softer kid. So there was a little bit, there's times where I sort of struggled with that.
Yeah.
I was quite emotional. So it would be a bit overwhelming sometimes, and obviously like maybe 11 or 12. But then as I sort of got older and my resilience developed,
mm-hmm,
and, you know, with the encouragement and the nurturing from Brian, managed to get through that. And then obviously as I became a cadet player and worked through my way through the juniors, you know, Brian was always there at every competition that I went to. It would come sort of all around the world to help and support. And
yeah,
I mean, that continued right through my senior career as well.
Yeah.
You know, and in terms of management and any sort of problem that I might have had, you know, I could always speak to Brian about it and he would be able to guide me and,
yeah,
help me along.
That's so interesting. In what ways, well, what methods did he use to sort of push you, I guess, outside of your comfort zone, but in a supportive way?
So the word character building was used a lot. Brian had this amazing ability to make you want to train hard,
yeah,
and just keep pushing on. And you sort of, you wouldn't want to let him down.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be sort of like you want to, you know, say if we're at so an example would be, you know, a squad session, right? So you got the Great Britain squad and he'd ask for volunteers and you want to know what you were volunteering for.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd be looking to see who put the hand up and who stepped forward. And usually it'd be something, I'm not going to say horrible, but like obviously there'd be some level of physical pain in it, whether, you know, you'd be out in the middle and it'd be pressure training if you're on the judo mat, or, you know, we used to do a lot of outdoor training as well.
Yeah.
You know, so we'd ask for volunteers, you'd put your hand up, and then before you know it, you'd be running up the side of a mountain with a log on your back.
Wow.
But he always had this ability to make people want to volunteer. You know, you wanted to put yourself, even though there's a slight amount of anxiety because you never knew what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Ultimately, you knew it was going to benefit you. You know, there was a point to it, and the point was to make you physically and mentally stronger athlete.
Yeah, for sure. And so did you always put your hand up, or was it like you had days when you did and days when you sort of waited for someone else?
The days where I waited became fewer and far between as I grew, as I got older. So
yeah.
In the beginning, you know, there was always that like bit of trepidation and, you know, being a bit more reserved.
Yeah.
But then, you know, once I also got through my teens, like late teens, and, you know, we were always at the front. Always at the front of the line with the hands up, and a lot of most of the time, like there was that little voice in your head saying, "Don't do it," but you know, you always did, and ultimately, you know, that's what made the difference. Like, I mean, what I did achieve in judo was only achieved because I was able to sort of silence that other little voice and push on. Otherwise, I would never have got as far as I did get.
Yeah, for sure. Silencing that sort of fear there.
Yeah, the little voice, a little bit of doubt, that sort of like, that basically the memory of the time before where, you know, you went through this horrible pain and you're like, you remember that pain? You know, it's, and then you're like, this is going to hurt and this is going to be unpleasant.
Yeah.
And you know that, like a rational mind always knows that, but then it's the ability to turn around and say, well, you know, I'm bargaining with that. Basically bargaining with yourself. You go, well, yeah, it did hurt, mm-hmm. but so what? Like, I'm still here, I'm still alive, I'm a little bit stronger because of it, so that's what this next opportunity is going to give me.
Exactly. And one of the things that I have seen floating around on social media, which sounds like it's sort of around this time, is that great video of you and some of the Great Britain teammates in full training mode. You know, you're running, you're outside carrying logs, you're doing weight training, you're doing judo, and it's...
Yeah.
Really professional. And is that around the same time?
Yeah, so I filmed that video in 2011. So it's mainly myself and one of my old training partners, Michael Hawley.
Yeah.
And the gentleman that filmed the video, I actually went to school with. So I've known Thomas White since I was three. And then he went up and he set up this media company. And
sure.
He was looking to develop his portfolio and include some sporting credentials to his I was speaking to him because we were looking at getting something done to help try and promote our training, and so that was and ended up just being huge. Like we thought maybe get like a couple of hundred video views at most, and
it looks great, and it's still floating around. What was it like during those days, living and breathing judo, training as hard as you did?
It was amazing. It was stressful. It was physically demanding, mentally demanding, exciting. Yeah, it was a large mixture of emotions. I mean, it wasn't all good.
Yeah.
But even so, the more negative sides of things were like fundamental to the development. So, I mean, a typical week would consist of probably training four times a day, sometimes five.
Four times,
so usually,
wow, 4 to 5 times.
So usually we'd do judo twice a day.
Yeah.
So there'd be a technical session and a randori-based session. There would be a weight training, strength and conditioning training element, and usually a run as well. I used to love running, so I used to do a lot of that. That was pretty much most days. We weren't paid, we weren't funded athletes, so we had to do work as well, you know. So that was the tough part, was just trying to make enough money to be able to pay for trips and try and pay for food.
That's a lot to think about, because you're mentally so focused on trying to improve your judo, and then to have to think about, you know, how am I going to get funds as well, that's quite a lot to bear.
I was very fortunate. There was a lot of, well, we lived in the judo club. So we taught judo classes. You know, I saw like where my, I'd done coaching before that, but more as an assistant coach. And then when we were living as full-time athletes, you know, we would pretty much coach the kids' programs. And that's where I really sort of got my my teeth into coaching as well.
Yeah.
And that would take care of some food and would also take care of like the accommodation, since they lived in the judo club.
Yeah.
But then in terms of paying for trips, you know, we well, a lot of manual labour. So mm-hmm. fortunate that we had, again, there was a number of people that were connected to the judo club who owned construction companies. Mm-hmm. So we'd do, you know, nothing that required any kind of thought, but, you know, turn up on building sites and shifting heavy objects around there. So around the building site. So in a sense, it was training as well. And there's actually a gentleman from New Zealand who was a judo player. He lived and he trained at our club, and he was the head brewer at a local brewery. Like a microbrewery.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I got a job there as well at the time, and that was fantastic. So it was just moving around the cask.
Yeah.
So a typical day's work there would involve moving 150 kilo casks. So again, it's just like getting paid to train.
That sounds really intense. Like, how are you still doing your four sessions a day plus turning up at that job? Did you dial back your training whenever you had to, you know, work at the brewery?
Or? Yeah, if I had work, I'd probably only do two sessions. But I mean, more often than not, you know, it depends. I mean, a lot of the time I'd run to work and run home. Yeah. So, I mean, work would be anywhere between 6 and 8 miles. What's that in kilometres? I don't know, 10, 11 kilometres, something like that. Yeah, so I do a 10K run to work all day, and then do a 10K run home, and then do judo in the evening.
Yeah.
So that would... So that would be pretty much...
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, got your steps up.
Yeah. I used to run everywhere. Like, I've never had a car, and I've always had a love-hate relationship with push bikes.
Yeah.
So
fair enough.
I usually just run.
So it sounds like your life is a little bit broader now. Like, you're creating and you're mentoring and you're contributing to a few more projects. And one of the things that I recently read that you posted was an article about reading. How has reading become something that has influenced you lately?
So again, reading was one of them things that I was never naturally inclined towards.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, I found reading a chore. Like, I'd happily go out and run and do sport and be physical, but sitting down and reading, that was something I saw as a massive chore, and I just did not enjoy it.
Yeah.
And as I got through university, you know, obviously I had to do a lot of reading at university, and again just found it a massive, massive chore, but just a necessary evil as part of the process. And when I finished uni and I started training full time, one of the sessions that we would do every week was a yoga session, and part of that yoga session would include like a 10, 15 minutes of meditation at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And this meditation section started to have had a massive impact on me at the time, and this is amazing, sir. And started talking with the teacher about this, and she recommended a few books, and so I read them, and then that's sort of pretty much where it started, where I started, you know, really got into reading. And
yeah,
again, is it like anything, you know, the more I did it, the easier it became, and the more I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And it sort of snowballed from then, really. So I mean, I was about maybe 19, 20 around that point.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I never leave the house without a book.
Wow. Because, you know, this article you posted was about Anna Karenina, and that's some pretty heavy reading. Like, that's a big book.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of my mentors, so a friend in the UK, over the years, we've backwards and forwards around books, and a lot of the stuff I would read would be probably under the sort of self-improvement and non-fiction category, you mm-hmm. know, all about this personal development side of things. I find the content of these books challenging, you know, a lot of the information, you know, maybe different concepts and things you've got to think about in a different way, and I found that aspect challenging, but the actual act of reading these books was very, very easy.
Yeah.
And I was sort of talking to my friend about it, and I basically said that to him. He said, well, maybe when you start trying to read something that's the actual, you know, the reading of the book's a challenge. He'd read a lot of this Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and he recommended these books. And
So I started off, sort of fell in love with these Russian literatures. I just absolutely love it. And yeah, it's like the reading of the book's a challenge. I mean, like reading a 900-page book would have been, I would never even considered it a few years ago. It'd just been outside of my reality, you know, in terms of I'd have found it very, strangely, I'd have found that intimidating.
Yeah.
Now I find, like, I want to read longer books, you know, I found the challenge in the books and I'm reading them, and I find actually reading the books very enjoyable. And for me, it's part of my meditation, my mindfulness practice, you know, sitting down and reading.
And so now if you look back at, you know, yourself when it was like 2011 and you're doing that really difficult training, now which books would you recommend that David to read? Which would you recommend?
The Chimp Paradox. It's a mind management book, so it's about... It's probably one of the books that really got me going in terms of understanding, obviously, how you behave and how you work as a human being. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Steve Pearce, he's done a lot of work with athletes, mm-hmm. and he's a psychologist. And the book's a really easy, really simplified way of explaining, you know, what's going on in terms of our behavior. And we can't maybe control something that happens, but we can control how we react to whatever that stimulus is. And it was a massive shift in my thinking in terms of how I behaved in general, but also very much so about how I behaved on the judo mat.
Yeah.
That was fantastic book. Crime and Punishment, mm-hmm. by Dostoevsky, which is like a recent one. Very enjoyable, very hard. It was like probably the first one I'd read by Dostoevsky, and it's probably one I'll read again in the future.
And, yeah. Is that fiction or non-fiction?
Crime and Punishment is a fiction. Again, it's a psychological. Again, it explores ideas of the mind and how, you know, how we work as humans, but in a fictional context. Yeah. Phenomenal book. Probably a book called Waking Up by Sam Harris.
Okay.
So I followed Sam Harris for quite a while now. He's got a fantastic meditation app, and he has a fantastic podcast. And, you know, so he's someone I followed for a while now, and he's got a lot of books discussing, you know, again, human behavior. He's got books on free will and but Waking Up is a lot it's more to do with consciousness and meditation and this the sense of self. It helped to make a lot of things that I was already thinking from like my own experience and other bits of reading, it helped bring it all together.
Yeah, for sure.
In that book.
Yeah. And isn't it amazing when you find someone who essentially puts a framework around your experiences, and it's like, oh, this person understands.
Yeah. I mean, actually, I recommended the Chimp Paradox to a friend. I keep getting text updates, obviously, as they go along, and they're obviously you can recommend this book to 100 people. It doesn't mean 100 people are going to enjoy it, but you know, it helped me, and obviously, I'm going to recommend it to other people. And it seems like it's helping this person as well. And they basically said just that, you know, it feels like this book was written for me. And it's interesting. Sometimes you pick things up and you're going through it and you're just like, you know, some things you think, oh, this is just me. You think, oh, I must be the only person that behaves in this way, right?
Yeah.
And you start reading this book and you go, actually, hang on. There's probably a large number of people that are thinking or, you know, going through exactly the same things that I'm going through here. And it's just nice when you get something like that you can go through and you're like, this makes sense. You have them little flashbacks to like times where you maybe behaved in a way, like maybe in an argument or something like that, and you go, ah, if only I'd read this then, I probably wouldn't have behaved in the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
But that's cool. You're sort of drawing lessons from yourself, from your own past, and using those as reflection points to become better.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you read a book like that and you finish reading it and you're like, well, there's nothing I can get from that book, you know, then obviously there's more things you need to look at and work on, because no one's perfect. Yeah. No one's perfect 100% of the time. You know, it's just impossible. So to be able to pick a book up like that, and, you know, you're always going to be able to take something from it. Yeah. I suppose you've just got to be open to the possibility that you can take something from it.
For sure. So I guess from your reading and the lessons you've gathered from judo, it sounds like you sort of consolidated this experience into your mentoring business. So can you explain to us a little bit about mindfulness and how that all sort of started?
Yeah, so like I said, in terms of my introduction to mindfulness meditation, it was through this yoga practice, maybe I think I was 20 when we first started doing that.
Yeah.
And so I started to read these books, and I realized I've been practicing mindfulness for pretty much from the first moment I started doing judo. For me, judo and mindfulness, they go together hand in hand. If you're not being mindful during a judo session, you're going to get thrown. So in terms of mindfulness, it's just being present to the task at hand.
Right.
So it's not necessarily sitting. I mean, you make a mindfulness practice, or like, you know, you're meditating. You can sit down or lie down, or, you know, however you want to position yourself, and you'll set aside 10, 20, you know, an hour, however long you want your practice to be, and you'll sit there and, you know, you'll just be present to your breathing, and you'll be present to any sensations, and you'll do that without being judgmental in any way. So, you know, if your mind starts to wander, you don't berate yourself for it. You just acknowledge the fact your mind's wandering.
Yeah.
Just bring it back to the present moment. So that doesn't mean you have to, that's the only way to practice mindfulness. You know, as I say, reading is mindful. You know, how often do you read a page? Mm-hmm. You get to the bottom of the page and you go, no idea what's going on.
You know,
because your mind's been wandering. Exactly. You know, your mind's been wandering. You've just not taken in, you know, we do it all the time, you know, like I probably read these books a lot quicker, but then I have to keep rereading pages.
Yeah.
Because your mind starts to wander. So again, having to sit, concentrate and read, mindfulness.
Yeah.
Again, judo. If you're practicing judo and you're doing randori, especially randori, you know, you're thinking about something else. Maybe you're worried about something, your mind's elsewhere. You're not going to be able to react. You're not going to be able to see someone try and throw you. You know, you're going to miss these and you're going to get thrown.
Yeah.
I suppose that's one of the beauties of judo, is the fact that, you know, if your mind does start to wander, you know, you get reminded of that pretty quickly.
Very quickly.
In a physical manner.
With a lot of impact.
Exactly. So you learn to be mindful sort of indirectly through judo, you know, and you have these moments where you're really focused and you do better. You know, you might not, you know, necessarily call it mindfulness, but that's pretty much what it is, or the way I see it anyway. And again, you go to competitions and you get nervous. You know, if you let them nerves consume you, mm-hmm. then you're not going to be able to perform well on the day.
Yeah.
You know, even if you get beaten, right, you can still fight amazingly well and still get beaten. So it's not even just so much like being mindful that ultimately means you're going to win.
Yeah.
You go to a competition, yes, you want to win, but there's still that understanding that you may not. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to a competition and you're in your head and your anxiety, you know, your nerves are consuming you and you're just burning a lot of nervous energy, again, there's more of a likelihood that you're not going to perform well. And there's more of a likelihood that you're not going to enjoy yourself as well, right?
Mm. In that scenario where there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of nerves, how do you bring yourself back to a mindful state?
So again, it comes down to training. Mm-hmm. So it's not just going to happen overnight. It comes down to training and doing those little 10-minute practices where you just sat on your sofa at home, or, you know, lying down in bed and you're practicing. Okay, that's when you put that into practice. So when you're in a judo competition, you start to feel yourself become nervous, you become aware of that.
Yeah.
There's ways of controlling your breathing, which affect your parasympathetic nervous system and just helps to relax you. You know, and again, you need a little bit of nerves at a competition. You don't want to be completely free of that nervous energy, because that adrenaline, that helps keep you sharp. But there's obviously a sweet spot where, you know, not enough, you're not going to perform well. If there's too much, you're not going to perform well. So, and you need to learn that about yourself. And again, it's just trial and error. You know, you practice, you develop the awareness within yourself.
Yeah, sure.
So when you know, okay, I'm getting a little bit too nervous now, I just need to calm myself down. Or, you know, you might be sat there relaxing and you go, okay, actually, I'm a little bit too relaxed. I'm going to be fighting in, you know, 10 fights time. You know, you're looking at the draw. You go, okay, well, I need to pick myself up now. And, you know, you learn how to be more aware of that.
Yeah. So you mentioned the parasympathetic nervous system there. What does that mean, and how does that connect to your breathing?
So it comes down to your fight or flight response.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you perceive a threat, you know you're going to go out and you're going to fight, okay? You're going to go out onto that mat and you're going to verse another person, and they're going to try and beat you, and you want to try and beat them. And obviously there's a certain level of unknown, like you know that's going to happen, but you don't know how the fight's going to go. You don't know how strong this person's going to be. You don't know, there's a lot of variables. So you're going out, and because of that, your body triggers the fight or flight response. You know, you notice the dryness in your mouth. You know, you're probably less able to focus and concentrate. Mm-hmm. Your mind's probably getting a bit all over the place. You're starting to think about, okay, what am I going to do? You know, you start to your head's going to different places. You know, you might start being thinking negative thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And by controlling your breathing and activating, I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong now, but the way I pronounce it is the vagus nerve. And you can do that through breathing. So the way of doing that is control. So you do like a slow breath in. So maybe you do it for like a three count. So you breathe in for three. And then when you breathe out, your out breath is longer than your in breath. So you want to aim for something around about double. So okay. Say if you breathe in for a count of three, you breathe out for a count of six. And that automatically triggers this nerve that responds in your body and calms your heart rate down.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, when, you know, fight or flight, your heart rate starts going, pumps blood around your body, because your body, in your head, it thinks there's this threat and you're going to have to either fight, which you are doing in a judo competition, or run away. You know, and just through this breathing technique and also just being able to like look at your thoughts and not attach meaning to the thought, you're able to distance yourself. You know, if you start getting to a negative thought pattern, especially at a competition, or I'm not good enough, or this person's better than me, or fought before, you know, and you start to identify with those thoughts, then it's going to have an adverse effect on your ability to go out there and perform to the best of your capabilities.
Yeah, for sure. I guess this is a timely conversation now because there's a whole lot that's up in the air at this very moment with all the coronavirus and the lockdowns and how that affects judo. Has it been an interesting experience for you to, I guess, put these skills to the test?
Yeah, very interesting. I obviously, this is like a horrible situation. Like, the world's never been in a situation like this, and you know, there's a lot of misery. Obviously, you know, a lot of people dying. It's a terrible, terrible thing. But it's not often that we're given this opportunity as a on an international scale to all be in a very similar position where we all have this massive amount of uncertainty and we are able to put our emotional intelligence to the test, really, you know, on such a large scale and for such a prolonged scale amount of time as well. It's quite often, you know, you might have, say, a judo competition, okay, so it lasts like, well, an afternoon. So, you know, you put your AI to the test there, or maybe, you know, if you're in an office, you've got to do a presentation and you hate standing up in front of people, you know, and that's, again, there's another example where, you know, you're going to have to, you know, look at controlling your emotions and, you know, working on that side of things. But it's a very small time frame, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest of the world are in various states of lockdown. And, you know, we don't know when this is going to end. We don't know how the world's going to look when this is all over. You know, it's an amazing opportunity to really put into practice everything you preach.
Yeah, for sure. Sure, and I see that you've pivoted quite quickly to offering personal training sessions, and
yeah, just being able to do some, like, doing other things, you know, things that you know, don't necessarily think about when you've got, you know, the judo clubs open. Obviously, you think outside the box, and as I say, you end up in a situation where you're either going to, you know, sink or swim.
And look, it sounds like all the work that you've been doing is setting you up to be part of that second group to make the most of what's going on at the moment to try and build yourself back up stronger.
Yeah. I mean, I you know, on Monday the 23rd, when they announced, you know, all the gyms were going to close, and I was basically to a point out of my main source of income was removed, you know, and I definitely panicked, you know. I had Monday afternoon and most of the following Tuesday where, you know, I was trying hard to, you know, bring myself into a position, you know, I was very aware of, you know, the level of anxiety I was experiencing, and, you know, I suppose, you know, I'm not saying just because you're aware of this doesn't mean it doesn't mean you don't experience it, but
yeah,
hopefully,
sure.
Hopefully I've just responded to it better than I otherwise could have done, but only time will tell on that one.
Do you think that's almost important as well, to experience a little bit of that fear and allow yourself to realize the gravity of the situation as part of the process to plan the next steps?
Yeah, definitely. I suppose there's always a point, right? So you've got to acknowledge the fact that the situation is what it is. Now you just got to be very careful that you don't blow the situation out of proportion, and then you also don't want to underestimate the situation. You know, you got to try and view it as realistically and logically as you possibly can.
Yeah.
And again, that's something that's not easy to do.
Yeah. For
you know,
sure.
We're all going to learn valuable lessons during this process.
Sure.
And yeah, no, I completely agree with what you say there. You've got, you know, part of the process is acknowledging that, you know, we're not in the best situation that we've ever been in. Yeah. But again, it's not the worst either. You know, and I'm not saying that I have all the answers, but, you know, I definitely don't have all the answers, but you know, certain things you can look at and go, okay, well, let's put it all into perspective. Let's look at what we need to do and how we need to do it. And, you know, going into lockdown seems to be like a very sensible thing to do.
So where does this lead you in terms of your mentoring businesses?
I was fortunate in the fact that a lot of the stuff I could do in terms of the mentoring and the coaching is, I was already doing quite a lot of it remotely anyway. That was, you know, I was already well versed in Zoom.
Yeah.
So I wish I'd bought shares in Zoom now, how popular it's become.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the stuff I was doing was, you know, via, like I say, Zoom or over the phone. So in that respect, I'm still able to keep that going. And obviously I've moved a lot more onto that kind of platform.
And if there are people listening to this podcast and they like the sound of what you're talking about, they feel really encouraged by what you're saying and they really identify with your approach, where's the best place for them to find you online or to follow you or to reach out in that way?
Probably my LinkedIn. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of social media, so I don't really have much of a presence. I am on LinkedIn and my handle is... So my LinkedIn is David-Piers, so that's P-I-E-I-S, Groom.
Okay, great.
Or you can go into Judo Way of Life.
Yeah, awesome. I'll link it as well in the description below. JudoWayOfLife.com.
Yeah.
Great. And last question before I let you go. What's next on your reading list?
Oh, I'm reading The Brothers Karamazov.
Right.
I probably pronounced that wrong. It's another Dostoevsky.
Another big, fat Russian book.
Page. Yeah.
For sure. Thanks so much for your time, David. Best of luck with your mentoring and building to come out on the other side of this coronavirus a stronger person.
Yeah, good. And thank you very much for having me on to talk. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in and listening to that episode. I sure hope you enjoyed it and got something out of it, whether it be inspiration, entertainment, or just tips on how to update your own training. Don't forget, if you have appreciated the Judo Edit podcast so far and want to chip in to support us, go to patreon.com/thejudoedit or click on the link below. Until next time, this is Melissa Budiato signing off.